the cool Miles Davis for a sizzling hot day. This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And later on, the Supreme Court doesn't have to overturn Roe v. Wade to decimate abortion rights.
Now, the Trump administration still salivating after its Supreme Court victory over public sector unions seems primed for the kill, as he has issued three executive orders further directed at the heart of federal workers' unions.
Meanwhile, these unions were already prevented from requiring workers to pay any dues or fees for the services they received, and aren't permitted to bargain for their workers' wages, and are prohibited from striking. But Trump's draconian orders go for the jugular, declaring, for example, a wage freeze for federal workers for the new fiscal year, and he wants to make it easier to fire them.
And Trump wants to completely hobble the union's ability to function by restricting union representatives' pay for the hours they spend on assisting the workers, and completely alter the rules for contract negotiations. And these are just the opening salvos of Trump's war on the workers.
And to explore further the Trump attack and the plutocratic frenzy against those who do the work, we're joined by Joe Davison, whose column, The Federal Insider, appears in The Washington Post. Joe is also a founding member of the National Association of Black Journalists and has been placed in its Hall of Fame.
And it's a pleasure to have you with us. Well,
thank you.
You know, I hardly know where to start. There's been a full court press by the Trump administration on federal workers. So maybe you can begin to take us through what are some of the most critical issues that now confront and erode the federal workers' unionized representation.
Well, executive orders, which were issued on May 5th, are really just among the latest examples of his attack on federal labor organizations. I guess it would start back in, August or September, when he issued another executive order which killed the federal labor management forums. Now, these forums were under President Obama. Actually, President Clinton had a similar operation. There was a slightly different title, but it was it's a situation which allowed organized labor leaders in the federal government and management to get together on a national level as well as on the agency-by-agency level to discuss discuss problems that are common in the workplace, such things as safety, productivity. One meeting I went to a few years ago had to do with the attack on the Office of Personnel Management, which hit about more than 20 million retirees and their families. And so it was discussing these kinds of things that were common to the workforce. Under the George W. Bush administration, those forums were discouraged, but they were not totally eliminated. Agencies still had the right to participate in those forums if they wished. Under the Trump executive order, the forums were basically all eliminated, and agencies were prevented from engaging in those kinds of discussions and those kinds of forums with local labor leaders, even if they found them to be productive, as many agency leaders do. So that happened. That happened now months ago. Like I said, either in August or September, when he came out with his budget earlier this year, the president indicated that unions basically get in the way of productivity. So he was kind of setting the rhetorical stage for these executive orders, which came out in May, and really totally upend, I think, the relationship between organized labor and management at the agency level and throughout the federal government. And it two things. One, a number of these labor organizations had good relationships with their local management, because having good communication fueled productivity. They dealt with safety concerns. And they dealt with these, the labor leaders dealt with these concerns for the entire bargaining unit. Under federal law, federal unions must represent everybody in a bargaining unit, even if they, even if some of those people don't pay dues. And that extends to filing grievances on behalf of workers who have a complaint against the an agency. Even if that person is not a union member, the labor organization is obligated to represent the person in the form of a grievance. And so with these executive orders, the Trump administration is really seeking to, and in fact, I think, has already weakened the federal labor organizations, and that's clearly a goal, and so far, Trump is winning.
Now, these executive orders were implemented on the 9th of this month. Can you give us an idea of what these three executive orders are?
Yes, one curtails official time. Now, official time is it's the kind of thing that I just mentioned, these discussions, say, between labor and management, not labor negotiations, not contract negotiations. But if a labor leader in an agency has conversations with management over such things as grievances or safety, productivity, health concerns that it might affect the entire workforce, that labor leader could be paid by the agency to represent the workers, and that labor leader would be considered to be on official time. And some labor leaders are on 100% official time. And so this has been a long-standing complaint by Republicans in Congress who have sought to either eliminate or really diminish or degrade official time. Now, could some official time, have there been some abuses of it? I don't know of any examples, but I wouldn't be surprised. But to eliminate it or to try to go after it as he did in this executive order, I think is really overkill in my view, because the administration essentially tries to pretend that official time is only for union activities. In fact, they even renamed it and called it something like taxpayer union time, and without any also said that it was unrestricted, when in fact the law says that that official time is not an unrestricted grant of taxpayer funded union time. Now that's the Trump term, unrestricted grants of taxpayer federal funded union time, when in fact the law says that this official time may not be used for, quote, the internal business of a labor organization, including the solicitation of membership, elections of labor organizations, officials, and collection of dues, close quote. And so the administration is attempting to recast the name of this official time and then falsely claim that it is unrestricted when it is, in fact, restricted by law. So one executive order would really curtail that that official time. Another executive order calls for the renegotiation of labor contracts. And the way labor contracts have worked traditionally in the federal government is if a contract expires and then a new contract has not been renegotiated at that point, then the terms of the previous contract simply basically roll over. The administration is now attempting to impose new terms on unions as soon as a contract expires, even if there is negotiations underway. And this actually started even before this this order came out. A number of weeks ago, the Education Department imposed a contract on its labor union, bargaining union, and it was a totally one-sided imposition. And they called it an agreement, but there was no agreement on the part of the union. And in fact, the contract that was imposed on the workers was one that the workers had previously rejected. So the second executive order dealt with renegotiating labor contracts in a way that would clearly be much more favorable to management. The other one would put a rush on civil service procedures in order to fire feds faster. Now, one of the things that executive order calls for, it calls for agency heads to try to negotiate an agreement that would mean that grievance procedures could not be negotiated. It says that they want to, as the wording is, endeavor to exclude dismissal disputes from the grievance procedure process. And if an agency is unable to do that, it has to provide an explanation to the president, to the director of the Office of Personnel Management, within 30 days. And so that's clearly putting pressure on agency managers to develop these rushed civil service procedures, which would allow feds to be fired faster.
Joe Davidson, you are really one of the preeminent authorities who have covered in your column, The Federal Insider, and so on, the issues of what is happening with the federal workforce. Can you contextualize this for us in terms of politics? On the tail of the Janus decision issued from the Supreme Court, and the fact that federal unions and public sector workers are one of the few remaining, even though they're less than they should be, but in terms of representation of a workforce as opposed to the private sector, what do these things really mean politically to the federal workers, to people in public sector unions? And where do you think this comes from? Because it certainly doesn't come from the spun cloth of the intellect of Mr. Trump.
Well, I think it's clear that the Republicans on the Hill and in some of the think tanks have been going after unions and things like federal pay for some time. I mean, I've been on this beat now for, I guess, 10 years, and it's been a recurring theme. Such things as going after official time. Places like the Heritage Foundation have put out reports suggesting that. That feds generally are overpaid, James Shirk, who formerly was at Heritage and who authored some of those reports, is now a domestic policy advisor to the president, and is behind some of this. He was the one who did a briefing not too long ago, another issue related to federal employees, and so. These things have been percolating within the Republican Party for some time, and it's not the kind of thing that I don't think that the president necessarily made a big issue of when he was campaigning. But there were people within his orbit, such as Newt Gingrich, who encouraged him to develop policies to fire feds faster. And I think he listened to them and others, and this is something that... was on that agenda, and it's, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who don't particularly like Trump, but Trump is a vehicle to get things done on the Republican agenda, and so they will go along basically with him, and with to hold their nose on the things they don't like because he'll give them plenty of stuff that they do like, and for those who are interested. You know, in tax policy, they got the tax bill. For those who have a particular thing about focusing on the federal workforce, they have these executive orders and an attempt to freeze federal pay again. He proposed that for 2019. I don't think that's going to go through. But he also proposed a number of hits, $143.5 billion worth of federal employee retirement hits over 10 years. The House upped them on that, and they've proposed $145 million. So I guess they considered $143.5 billion cheap. And so they upped them by $1.5 billion in terms of the amount of retirement hits to federal employees over 10 years. And so I think that he being Trump is perfectly fine to go along with these things. I don't think he had a particular thing for jamming federal employees before. But you know, they say, look, this is a good idea, and he is willing to go along with it. Clearly, he is.
I also want to just ask you. The issue of who is in the workforce and who has been in the public sector, which has, during the 70s and so on, brought, as a government expanded in social programs, etc., there were more people of color and there were more African-American women, etc., brought into right. the workforce. So how do you think these onerous, draconian, as you describe them, orders and restrictions impact on the economic solvency and ability to stay, if you will, in the middle class of the later hired, the African-American workforce?
Well, the government, and I think probably particularly the post office or the postal service, certainly the postal service was long known as a place where black people would get hired when other places would not hire them. Now, the postal service, I should quickly add, is not included in this because the postal service is kind of a, now it's almost kind of a quasi-public agency. It's not funded directly through, it's still a federal agency, but it's not funded by the government, by the budget. It creates its own funding through the sale of its goods and services. That apart, federal agencies in general also have been more than others, to be sure, have been known as a place where people, black people in particular, could find work. Now, the representation, the overall workforce representation, is for the black community, it's a few to several points higher than the general population. I think it's in the federal workforce, if I recall the figures correctly, the black population is probably around 17 or 18%. So it's a few points higher. Now for the Latino population, they are underrepresented in the federal workforce, and it's also true that in the senior executive service, which is the top level of the civil service, that Latinos are well underrepresented. Women are underrepresented. Black people are underrepresented at the top levels. And I should also add, I guess, that this effort to fire feds faster really actually started with senior executives in the Department of Veterans Affairs. And so legislation was passed when Obama was president that allowed senior executives to have fewer civil service protections and allowed them to be fired more quickly than others. Getting back to your overall question, certainly as it relates to black people in the federal workforce, we are basically overrepresented, to use that term, in the general workforce in the federal government. And so to that extent, these kinds of hits on federal unions and federal employees would also then hit black people more than others to that extent.
Joe, there's a whole list of other things that the administration wants to do, the Trump administration, including making such things as child care and training, discrimination, and performance appraisals not grievable. And a number of those are the kinds of things they want to put into their new contracts, which they will do when the old contracts expired, despite the objections of the unions. So in what ways is this an opening salvo to a much wider attack than even this on the federal workforce?
Well, I guess one thing is I'm not sure it's an opening salvo, because I think that probably came last year, and so it continues the salvo, you might
okay,
say.
Okay, I'll go along
but,
with that.
So we're not necessarily at the right at the beginning, although I think that what will happen, I think, also will depend on the outcome of court cases. You know, if they go much further, I think will depend on whether or not the unions are successful in fighting these executive orders, which they are attempting to do right now in federal court. And there's going to be a hearing later this month. And, of course, you know, these kinds of court cases can drag out for a while. I think it remains to be seen. I think that if they are allowed to renegotiate contracts under these kinds of terms that are outlined in the executive orders, that would really make it much more favorable to the Trump administration. If they are able to really cut back or continue cutting back on official time, then the unions, I think, clearly will be in a weakened posture. And I think that that might be all they need. I mean, they might not need a lot more because if the contracts are going to be perhaps imposed on workers as they were, as has happened at the Department of Education, then that means that if they have that ability, that essentially is the ball game. Now,
right.
Having said that, something else might come out next week that, as folks say, this administration, wow, I thought it was bad, and then this happened. and so something could happen next week that I'm not thinking of at the moment. But it seems to me that if they have the ability to impose a contract on a union, then that's really pretty powerful. And I don't know how much more, what more they might need to do.
Well, they're saying that before the midterms, they'll get out a whole new slew of proposals, I think.
Before the midterms, that is true. Before the midterms, they plan to put out more civil service procedures. Now, that doesn't relate necessarily to unions strictly, which is what I was thinking of. The civil service reform proposals would affect the entire workforce, those who are unionized and those who are not. And my guess is, and certainly they've made it clear from what they've already done, that one of the main things they want to do in terms of civil service reform is to make it easier for management to fire people more quickly and certainly more efficiently, in their view. And so I think that's something else that definitely will come. I think another key component would involve the way federal employees are paid. They want to make that more market sensitive, and many people who even argue for market sensitive pay at the federal level recognize that those at the higher level are already underpaid. You know, your lawyers and your doctors who are federal employees could make much more in the private sector, but it's also true that those who are at the bottom of the pay scale or near the bottom on the federal employment, there have been studies that indicate that they are paid more than their counterparts in the private sector. Now, these studies, there's a lot of controversy around these studies. But if the people who are in the lower ranks of the federal government are paid more compared to people in similar positions in the private sector, then any attempt, unless it's very finely tuned, to make federal pay more market sensitive is really going to hit those who are already at the bottom of the federal pay scale harder because of the information indicating that they, relatively speaking, are better paid than people in the private sector. And so that's going to be very controversial. Also, the whole notion of pay for performance, which this market sector pay kind of is related to, has a bad history within the federal government, certainly among labor organizations. The Defense Department years ago had a pay-for-performance system that was found to discriminate against women and people of color, black people and brown people. And Congress repealed that system in the first couple of years of the Obama administration because the complaints against that pay-for-performance system were so strong, and it had so little support by the employees that Congress eventually repealed it. And so this whole notion of pay for performance, which is related to, though not necessarily the same as market system pay, market-based pay, really has a lot of opposition among organized labor because of their experience with it.
Now, here's the most difficult question. Joe Davidson, you are a founding board member of the National Association of Black Journalists, and you've been placed in its Hall of Fame. Where's your book? When do we get to read about your experiences, which are of seminal importance also?
Well, I appreciate that, I guess all I can say on that front is that you're not the first one to ask me, and I guess I'll have to say I'll let you know.
Well, here's what
the guy
we'll
writes about
do.
One column a day for the Washington Post.
Well, we're going to have you back, and you know, we're just going to record these things, and then you can easily transcribe that into the book that you absolutely should do. Your contributions are of such vital importance, and the decimation of organized labor and the contempt for working people in this country, and what you can bring to the subject by virtue of your coverage these many years, and how prolific you are, just another source of encouragement, and also a way of saying that we really thank you for taking the time to be with us and educating
us. I appreciate that very much. Let me say one thing, though, about the decimation of organized labor. One thing that Trump has done, I think, he has encouraged people to join federal unions. I did a piece in October. It was after this earlier executive order where he did away with these labor management forums. And three of the top four federal labor organizations, federal unions, told me that their membership had increased under Trump. The fourth one just didn't comment one way or another. And so I wouldn't be surprised if their membership increased also, but they're kind of secretive to an extent, so they didn't tell me. But it's clear that at least three of the four top federal unions, as of October when I last looked into this, their membership had increased under Trump, I think because of Trump's attitude toward the workers and organized labor.
So,
and so I'm not exactly calling that a bright side, but it might be that an attempt to hit the unions can backfire and might make them stronger than ever. There's only so much they can do in the federal government. They're not allowed to strike, for example, and so they don't have as much power as private sector unions to that extent. But they are growing, as private sector unions are not.
So you've encouraged us all to end with that admonition of don't mourn, organize, and we are clear that the labor unions and the working class are beginning the fight back. And thank you for taking time to be with us. I really encourage people to check out the Federal Insider, which appears in the Washington Post. And who knows, we may have
WashingtonPost.com. That's where they can.
Okay.
And
it's
we may have
it.
Joe back very soon to talk about his first chapter of his important book.
Listen, I really appreciate that.
Thank you. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we have been speaking with Joe Davidson, an extraordinary writer, great columnist. Check out the Federal Insider, which does appear in the WashingtonPost.com. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.